What's up, guys? Welcome to Winnipeg's Finest, the podcast where we get personal with notable Winnipeggers. If you haven't been with us before, here's what you've missed.
Like, I even feel like I've always known that I was supposed to be here, so it's like, even if there was stuff that I went through, I always went through it knowing that this isn't, like, the end of everything, you know what I mean? This isn't the end of the world. If there's anything, actually, that I would tell myself, is to not be so afraid of failure.
Oh, yeah. How different was it for you to watch a movie where Kevin Spacey is the villain?
I mean, I feel like they just told him to be himself.
It's like, dude, be a shitty person who's a predator and, like, does bad things. And
yeah.
Kevin Spacey's like, I got you.
Oh, boy, this is my role.
Hey, Mr. Professor, look at me, make money.
What? Call campus security.
Thank you so much to the fans who continue to support. You guys are awesome. We love you like crazy. This is why we love podcasting. This is why we love bringing you guys episodes. Please remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you're listening. Remember to follow us on social media at WPGS Finest Pod on Instagram. And make sure you're staying posted and telling people about the podcast. We appreciate and love the support you give us. So just know that it lifts us up so much and we're very grateful.
What's up, guys? Welcome to a brand new episode of Winnipeg's Finest. Today's guest is comedian Mike Green. We talk about a lot of things, comedy. We talk about books we read. We talk about what's more embarrassing, shitting or pissing yourself in public. It was a great time. Today's episode is brought to you by Unity Underwear, the best place on the planet to get underwear. It is 95% made of bamboo, 5% spandex. It feels fucking fantastic, and you can use our code WPGSFINEST to get 20% off all your purchases there. We're also brought to you by Jellyfish Float Spa, the best place in the world to receive the wonders of float therapy. And if you use our code WPGSFINEST, you get 15% off all float purchases there as well. In the meantime, here's our episode with Mike Green.
Bad boy. And we're on. Mike Green, good to see you again.
Good to be here. I haven't done one of the Zoom shows yet.
Yeah. Have you done a Zoom comedy show yet?
Not really. I did a live cast show at Rumors, which was I guess like a Zoom show, you see the audience a little bit too, so like that makes it a Zoom show. So I just did a live stream show. So technically different.
What was that like?
It wasn't bad, to be honest. Well, the reason it wasn't bad is that was like in June. Maybe, or before June, so like there was still like the under 10 person limit, but you had the other comedians in the room. So it just felt like if you've ever just done like a really shitty open mic, you know, where there's just comedians, that's your audience. It didn't feel like there was no audience. It felt like there was a small audience of comedians. So you're making them laugh. And then sometimes you had live stream comments and like that was fun enough, I guess.
Okay. So you kind of had like a gauge for timing. It wasn't just like dead space.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it. Yeah, I wouldn't do a show to no one. Or like sometimes people do Zoom shows where you're zooming in, and I don't think you get to see everyone in the Zoom audience. You're literally just like speaking into the void, and like I wouldn't want to do that either. But yeah, and honestly, in Winnipeg, we're very lucky that like when shows were going on, like regular open mics, there was never an open mic where there was just comedians. Well, there was some, but they were the really, really crummy ones. We're lucky that even our open mics here have audiences, but I've done other cities, you know, and I know that in most other cities, an open mic means you're just going up to other people who are waiting to do their time. So this was even better than that, because this was better than a shitty open mic, and that the other comedians there were at least like engaged and we were actually all having a good time.
Yeah, I think what you meant to say was there was no open mic that you did.
Yeah, that's true. And that's actually not true. When I first started, the worst open mic, arguably, was at Solid Gold at 6 p.m. There's a strip club DJ at Solid Gold who just, he wanted to do stand-up. And so he decided to get open mic going before the first dancers. And so there was just us and then sometimes like a couple old men who clearly thought that the show started at 6 and they were just there for girls. Yeah, but it was good practice at that point. It was, you know.
That's awesome, actually. Like, it really teaches you to deal with subpar circumstances.
Yeah, and honestly, yeah, one point or another, you can do a show where there's nobody there except other comedians. So I did my time.
Was there anybody there that was like doing comedy with you that like I know now that's still pretty good?
Honestly, if guys who went to Solid Gold, I don't know. Dan Glaswick is a guy, but you would have never met him. He moved to Toronto, and he's focusing on his job now. But I think maybe Paul might have done one solid gold. Jordan might have done one or two. But me and Glaswick were there every week. We were pretty into it.
Was it a comedy end stay for the later show special for you?
Look, I'm not going to pretend I'm better than going to the strippers. Sex work is work. So I'm just a customer. So I have been to strippers. And on those nights, like, I think we'd stay for like the first couple dancers, more or less out of politeness, because I feel like some of them ended up watching us while they were getting ready to go up. So, you know, game recognized game. You gotta wait for the first dances. But it was also like 7 o'clock on a Tuesday. So it was never the night where we just got lit up or anything. Those were Thursdays. Thursday was okay to get lit up, not Tuesday.
Yeah, that's kind of a strange night to turn up, where you're like, yeah, Tuesday night, that's where it's really happening right now.
It's not any stranger than Thursday. And to be honest, when I was younger, when I was like 18, 19, I had these Filipino friends that I knew from online gaming. And basically, they were good guys, but they're all older than me. I was like 18, 19, they were in their 20s, and we'd all go to Monday at Monty's. Monday nights was the OC, which I don't think exists now. It's a different bar on Pembina. And there's free strippers and free poker or something. So like, I used to do that on Monday when I was 19. So really, it's not that different.
Yeah.
I would have been like 22 in the solid gold era of comedy. So yeah.
Oh geez. Okay. So that was a while ago.
Yeah. It was like, I might have even been 20. I don't think it lasted long, and it was right when I first started. So yeah, probably when I was 21.
Yeah. And then you started your open mic, or you took over.
I started pretty much 21. I was the same age, because I was, I started it like the April. I started September 2009, and then I was already running it by April, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fair. So yeah, you've almost got your 10 years in.
I should be 11 years now, pretty much. Like September 2009 was the official start date. Oh, and then 10 years at the Handsome Daughter. Yeah.
Yeah. Just 10 years of running your open mic.
Yeah, there's a little bit of downtime in between, like, because the bar, especially in that first era, was, like, really, like, changing hands a lot, because it was such a sketchy place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, when COVID hit and everything, did you kind of think that it would take as long as it did? Nice brand, by the way, the mug. Nice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look at that. It's the Call Me the Handsome Daughter mug.
Yeah, just in case anybody forgot.
Yeah, just flexing.
When
COVID started.
Yeah, did you think that we'd get comedy at all till the winter, or no?
I thought so, at least especially here where things were light, and then and things were looking good. Like, we had our best, that sort of July, August, when things were running, was things were going great. Or I guess, yeah, we were more going in August and September. But I thought it would get going, and then now I honestly don't know what to think. Like, I think what's likely is that things just kind of stop and start consistently for God knows how long.
Do you think eventually we're just going to start treating COVID like lactose intolerant people treat dairy?
How do lactose intolerant people treat dairy? Like, how are you saying we're going to treat COVID?
we'll stop at
people who are worried about it. I think that's already going on.
They'd rather just deal with the consequences.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not lactose intolerant. I think if I were, I would be pretty sensitive to it, and I would not try not to shit my pants in front of people. But if that's how those people are handling it, then I'm not going to tell them how to live. You know, I'm not going to tell them how to deal with their struggle.
Yeah, but to be fair, you also haven't lived with shitting your pants in front of people for an extended period of time, so you don't really know the ins and outs of it, right?
That's true. I've never shit my pants as an adult, and I take some pride in that, because there is a hacky thing in comedy. And I did this one time at a crowd work show where I was just talking about it, because like, I feel like older guys in comedy all have a bit about shitting their pants, and it always starts with like, and if you haven't shit your pants, like, your day's coming. And it's like, no, old man. Like, I know how to not go full diaper, you know, on a day-to-day basis, right? But then the show I told, I have a not a shitting story, but a pissing story, which may be just as bad, really. But have you guys ever shit your pants as adults?
No. Is it worse, though? Like, I feel like pissing is better.
Well, you have to understand this story involves, like, I can pretty much tell you, I did it at a show, because I talked about how old guys always have this shitty thing. I feel like it's dumb. It's gross out. And I said it, so I don't have that, but I do have a story that is maybe in the realm. I don't know if it's going to be just as hack as if I tell it. And then it was a crowd work show, so I asked somebody in the crowd to admit that they shit their pants, and one girl did admit she shit her pants. She was drunk, said she realized about 15 minutes before it was going to happen that it was going to happen, but she couldn't get to the bathroom, and, you know, she fucking shit herself. Anyway, crowd all agreed that was bad, you know? And then basically my story, I'd come home drunk after soccer, as I do.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I would come home after soccer, I'd come home sweaty and I would not shower because I just sort of plan it where it's like, well, I'm going to wash my sheets in the morning. Like I hadn't done sheets all week. So like, you know what? I know I'm going to play soccer that night. I know I'm going to come home at 2 a.m. drunk, not want to bother showering. I'm just going to fall asleep sweaty and it's not gross because I'm just going to wash all everything in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these nights, where I was especially drunk, I woke up in the night, still hammered, really had to go to the bathroom. And somehow didn't want to go to the bathroom, even though I didn't want to stand up, even though the bathroom was right next door. So I basically decided that since I was going to wash the sheets anyway, I could just sort of pull them off and like wad them up and like piss into them. And like the remainder would just sort of be in my cupped hands. Like I was like, this is fine. This is a system. And then I was just pissing and I realized, overwhelmed by the volume of urine, realized I had to try and squeeze it off, lob these piss stained sheets into the hamper. And then go into the bathroom and shower off, and ended up showering anyway. And I woke up in the morning, didn't even remember doing it. And I was like, why is there a towel embedded? Why is there sheets over there? And the crowd decided that what's worse, shitting yourself accidentally or pissing into your own cupped hands intentionally. They agree my thing was actually worse. So, you know, you is asked it, how.
Here's where I push back. Nobody would have known until you told it.
Right. That's not really a defense because potentially nobody would have known if this lady shit herself, if nobody had known it. I mean, the question is not what's worse when the world finds out. The question is like just what is more embarrassing, to like be drunk and overwhelmed and not realize you need a bathroom so you need it, or like I knew as I woke up that I needed the bathroom and I just somehow had the impression that pissing into my wadded up sheets was a solution. And look, the crowd that night said that they felt my thing was actually more embarrassing than shitting yourself. So,
I mean, you were drunk.
I was drunk. And in fairness to me, actually, what I say in my defense is that after everything was sorted out, I did wash the sheets and it was fine. I didn't get any in my bed. So, like, was I wrong? Was I wrong? My plan worked out.
Mm-hmm.
My plan worked out.
And that's not pissing yourself. That's deciding to piss into your sheets. That's different.
Yeah.
See, that's an adult decision. That's just what adults do.
Child couldn't make that decision. Child would never even think of that. I was a man. I said, hey, I'm going to do my own laundry tomorrow. This is fine.
So, like, okay. So, do you sleep naked?
No, I don't. I typically don't. I don't think I was that. And I think I just took my boxers off. And
okay.
Probably so just wadded them up in the ball, too. I don't know.
So you just slipped them off. Yeah, that's not pissing yourself. Pissing yourself is you got clothes on, right, and you're soiling your clothes.
Regardless, what people seem to latch onto that night was just the fact that this was a concerted decision on my part. That would seem to be what was horrifying to the room at large that night. Or they just wanted to offer support to the nice lady who admitted in the room full of people that she shit herself, which I appreciated. It was I went up last on a crowd opening, so literally everybody had been talked to. And I did a little parlor trick that I've done before. It was like maybe 20, 22 people in the room. And I just throughout the night made sure to be in the room as everyone was getting talked to. And I learned every person's name.
Mm.
And so I went up last. And then I was like, you know, well, this is great. Go up last on a crowd work show when everyone's been talked to. Who am I going to talk to? Jason? Am I going to talk to Sophie? And I just like went through everybody's name.
Mm.
So I gained their trust and their admiration, I feel like, there. And that made this lady comfortable enough to then, as I worked through the crowd stuff, she admitted she shitted herself.
That's a real pro move. That's a real savvy vet move right there.
That's because I'm a very savvy vet, Bueno, as you may or may not know. I'm one of the wiliest vets in the game. So.
Yeah, I'm sitting here just in admiration. You know, under 2 years into comedy, half of one of them doesn't count because of COVID, but.
Yeah. But speaking of crowd work, I was just reviewing old footage, and I reviewed footage from your No Regrets show.
Yeah.
You've been back. You were, you know, anybody wants to say anything about Bueno's comedy, I'll give you your credit as a hustler that you constantly ask for shots, which I might not give them, but I appreciate that you're trying and that you're engaged and you asked to host a show and you came up with the No Regrets, which is a good theme show because it's a theme. And for some goddamn reason, the Gen Pop needs a theme. They need to feel like there's something to come out to, even though I could be like, hey, no theme, but it's the best comedy you'll see maybe in the country tonight. I got all these great comics. And they're like, yeah, no thanks. And you're like, well, it was a night where people are going to eat a hot wing and then they might like shit themselves on stage and like, oh, I'm there, you know? So they want a theme, and No Regrets is a good theme because it sounds like a theme. But in fact, if you're any sort of comedian, you can kind of tailor most of your, like you can make a lot of things fit under that theme, you know?
Yeah.
Regrets. And And so I was doing No Regrets show, and then I was just talking to somebody in the crowd about their regrets, and I ended up posting a clip of that from the Handsome Daughter account recently. I don't know if you saw, but
yeah, I saw.
Yeah. So yeah, anyway, in terms of being a Wiley vet, I don't mind doing the crowd work, but I'll give you your credit that I benefited from your hustle that night because you put the show together, and it was a good one.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Because even like you said, anything kind of fits under the umbrella of regrets. Even if you don't do anything about stuff you regretted. At the end of the set, you could be like, well, I don't regret doing that, you know, and just hack your way into the theme.
Yeah. And it's a fun show to involve the crowd, because if you get any sort of crowd that's willing to take a chance with you, whatever, I just asked the lady in the front row, like, what's your big regret? And then she gave me something, and then I riffed something for a few minutes off that.
What'd she say? She regretted getting married young?
She got married at 18.
Ooh.
Rough.
Too young. And then I posted the question, would you rather get married at 18 or join a cult? Because that's where I took it in that moment on stage. And overwhelmingly people feel they would join a cult rather than get married at 18.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, all religions are cults anyway, so odds are we're in one regardless.
And if you're getting married at 18, you're really just subscribing to the cult of marriage, the cult of love. So that's really not any better.
I mean, think back to like when you were 18, how different are you now? Like, God, I can't imagine expecting somebody to grow with me on the same path.
Absolutely. I should honestly not be allowed. I should be criminal. But as I joked with that lady on stage, like, why'd you do it? Like, didn't anyone in your life tell you it was a bad idea? But yes, of course they tell you. And of course you don't listen, because of course you feel you have some conduit. You're different. And you have some conduit to knowledge or something, and you're going to make it work. And you might. There's certainly no saying you might, but like, I definitely think, you're shortchanging yourself and your life experiences if you kind of tether yourself to that right off the bat.
Okay, so if you had to make it illegal to be married when you're 18, what's the legal marriage age in your mind?
20-25 would be more of a, just seems like a natural thing. At 21, you're still pretty much the same soft-headed dummy. Like, the difference between an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old is negligible, in my opinion. But honestly, 25 is like, you're kind of just starting to come out of that. And I know, I want to say, I know a lot of dumb 25-year-olds, but like, it's not inconceivable that you're haven't really matured at all. So like, 30 might be good, but, honestly, it's hard to say, because you can never make it work for everyone. Some people are still, frankly, quite dumb at age 30. So
I think they should make like some sort of reading requirement when you get married. Yeah. Like, how many books have you read since you graduated high school? Oh, two, maybe, and you lied about that number? Okay, no, you can't get it.
Bro, I would not be getting married. That doesn't work.
Yeah, I'm looking.
Do I not deserve to get married?
No, you don't. I'm looking specifically at your weird 2006 gamer YouTube angle that you got going on.
Yeah. And your hippie mushroom background. Like, that would be great if we were tripping. That towel would be great if we were tripping.
Tapestry. Don't call it a towel. I wouldn't dry myself with this art.
But would you pee into it?
Probably, if I was tripping hard enough.
Yeah.
If you were drunk and sweaty enough at 5 a.m.
If I start tripping, I'm like, oh, it's a tree. That makes sense. That could work.
Yeah, pee on a tree.
Yeah. That's a logical logical thought process.
Mike, did any of your bed sheets have toilet paper like themes on them?
No. I can't put it on anybody but myself. I want to be magnanimous. I want to own that defeat and say that it was completely my fault. And that I didn't really think it through, that I guess, like, in my mind, like, I would have my cupped hands after the sheets if they got overwhelmed. But, like, what was I going to do with that? Like, throw my pistol pants into the bathroom and then still not shower? None of it made sense. You know, I want to own that and say it was a bad choice, you know.
Thought it through, just, like, not thoroughly.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought as far as I don't want to get up and, like, this will allow me to not get up. I probably, like, if I cast around, there might have been a water bottle. So I could have done a lot of things, but what I did, could have done a lot of things.
Yeah. But hey, you learn for next time. Next time, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Live and you learn. Next time you won't piss in your hands.
And I've heard way worse from guys who are drunk and like, my girlfriend was in the bed and I just stood up and like, I pissed in the bed because I didn't even know what was going on. And I still haven't shit myself. At the end of the day, I still haven't shit myself. And that's what I want to go out on, you know.
And that's something to be proud of. See, Kanan, really quickly, this is why I like the other angle better, because the tapestry covered the entire background. Now it just looks like it's not your background. It just looks like a towel. Mike's right. It does look like a towel. And I'm half expecting you to tell us that, I don't know, the government created Al-Qaeda at some point. in this episode.
They did. You didn't know that?
I know, but I'm just
falls right in front into the Cheez-Its. Oh man, what a great thing to fall into. Just a fucking box of Cheez-Its.
How's that better? Is that better?
It's kind of better, to be honest. It looked, it fills more of the void now, so it does create an impression.
Yeah, and you got the little basketball hoop there, so it gives us an idea that like you kind of got like a cool hobby.
No, I'm unathletic as fuck.
That looks much better. Let's start the whole thing over. Because honestly, we probably turned off anyone who doesn't like the phrase "shit themselves," which I think is most people. Most people have a bad reaction to that. They probably already tuned out. And again, I want to own that. I started that all. I went into it.
You know what? I'm about to make it maybe worse. No, actually, there seem to be a lot of people I know who are into this. I was at the gym today, and they had Dr. Pimple Popper on the TV. I almost threw up. Like, this is fucking disgusting. Why is this playing?
Yo, those videos are satisfying as fuck.
See, there we go.
Yeah. I don't know what to say because I don't watch it now. It's like she has her own TV show now. But like, I'll admit, I was on the YouTube channel as it was blowing up. There's a certain style of them that I do find very gratifying, even as I know they're super gross. I definitely wouldn't have it on at the gym. I mean, that I feel like it should be illegal, but you know, it's COVID rules, baby.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, stay 6 feet apart and try not to throw up on each other.
That's my new explanation for a lot of things. It's COVID rules, baby.
What's the weirdest thing you've had to explain with COVID rules?
Honestly, it's hard to say now because I feel like, and I haven't been saying it a ton, but I have been throwing it out casually enough. I can't remember the actual last time I said it or what I would have said it for. Yeah, that's a good question. You caught me out here because I said it so much it just became ubiquitous. You know,
hey, if you ever have a girl over and you know things don't go the way you want with the equipment, then you can just tell her that's how COVID goes.
That's COVID rules. I don't think that's a symptom. Just so we're clear, just so people don't start calling health links because they can't get it up. That's not COVID.
Yeah, then we get a Narcity Canada article talking about how Viagra will actually cure COVID-19.
Is Narcity, that's the, oh no, the Beaverton is the spoof one. What's Narcity, do they do short videos though too? Do they do comedy videos?
I have no idea what they actually do. I think they just
I'm thinking of the Hard Times. The Hard Times is like a weird, it seems more like band humor, musician humor. But I see some of their articles come up and I'll give credit where credit's due. Because sometimes even me just like being vaguely, related to music and performers. Like I get it and they're good headlines and they're good spoof articles.
Yeah, the Babylon Bee is one of those spoof articles on Instagram that I know some of my friends are huge into. It's like, it's politics though, so I don't know. They had one of the headlines was like, Mark Zuckerberg now hides under your bed to remind you to vote in the middle of the night or something like that.
All right, so I got to say, I feel like nobody ever is going to listen to this all the way through, not to disparage you guys immediately, but...
No, it's okay.
Let's be honest, it's a small cast, so I got to assume you had some questions. So give me some things so that I can say something concise and smart, and then we can maybe get one presentable bit out of this.
Oh, okay.
Do you have any questions ready?
Okay, yeah. Okay, is it gay to suck your own dick?
Yeah, this is going to be my soundbite. No.
Okay, present your argument.
I mean, you must have had, you didn't have one other thing actually prepared for this. I'm embarrassed for you, Bueno. How do you have like 100 episodes? How do you have 100 episodes and you're not more prepared than this?
See, I was ready to take it another direction or like just kind of play the conversation. Then you stopped in mid conversation. You're like, let's ask questions now. I was like, oh shit.
Well, I felt like we were already way off the beat, way off on the tangent. So if you were actually building to something there, by all means, hit me with this master plan. But I know for a fact you weren't. I know for a fact you had shit all. Kanan's down there fucking puffing joints. Hanging out in his hippie freakout basement.
I ain't even high right now. What the fuck?
Oh, weren't you popping? I thought you were hitting the joint before.
No, this is a jewel.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I apologize.
Yeah, there are levels to addiction, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, I've vapes, bro. I vape. I get it. I'm still cool. I'm still one of the kids. I know jewel. I know what jewel is.
I mean, on our episode with Jasmine Lane, she's an radio host, and we ended up talking about the difference between tomato sauce and pizza sauce, which is the same fucking thing as tomato sauce. It's just a different kind of tomato sauce. But Kanan's 6 years old and thinks that pizza sauce is a real thing, and that's where we got lost. in our conversation.
Did Jasmine agree with you or with Kanan?
She agreed with me because she has an IQ over 70.
I see.
Yeah. And then somebody...
Well, I mean, look, then I'm going to go Team Kanan just to level the score and say that, yeah, well, I'm certain at the low level, you're just looking at tomato sauce as tomato sauce. I would say that definitely there's some places that are making authentic pizza sauce and that you wouldn't use that in all the situations that you use tomato sauce. You know, that there's different herbs that are going into it because, you know, a tomato sauce going on pasta and a pizza sauce going on pizza. So, you know, you're both wrong as far as I'm concerned.
I'm just going to go with the fact that Kanan's wrong. That seems like a pop. Oh, did you? Okay, I'll take it this way, actually. I'll take it this way. We started doing After Dark episodes, like new segments with Sarah London. You see that?
I saw you're doing After Dark segments. I didn't realize that what makes an After Dark. I assumed that After Dark segment was like, that was where you put all the clips where you're talking about shit in your pants. No, so what makes an After Dark segment an After Dark segment is that it features Sarah London?
Yeah.
Strictly. Why didn't you call it something fucking London related then?
No.
How is After Dark supposed to let me know like that's what makes an After Dark segment? I assume that's when it got dirty and like that's when you get a little blue.
Yeah, that is where we get dirty. Sarah's just the co-host on that. It was an idea presented to us by one of our friends who shall not be named. She left the podcast and asked us to take down all content with her. So we're doing After Darks with this person and we're having a lot of fun with it because it wasn't like about the guest or trying to converse with the guest and bounce stuff off that's kind of relevant and have like more intellectual conversations. We just kind of bullshit and laugh about stupid stuff. Like, I don't know, just weird sex stories or drunk or whatever, you know, adult conversations. And then she bounced and we're like, oh fuck, we need a third person. And one of the reasons why she bounced was because she said like, she felt like it wasn't good for her image. It was kind of like bringing her image down. So I was like, who is a group of people who like has no dignity and don't worry about their public image being ruined? I was like, comedians. So I asked Sarah.
Right. And has she been working out as the After Dark host?
Yeah, Sarah's dope.
Very well. Great. Okay.
I didn't know if she could go dark enough. You know, I'm not, I don't know what her day to day, I don't know what her, how she gets down. But yeah, no, I didn't. I saw you post those links and I did not from the name gather. I mean, I guess if it's, that's when you want to keep it dark. But yeah, I had no idea that Sarah was a part of it. And I feel like it's missing some sort of play on London. So it should be some sort of. Going across the pond with Sarah London. That's terrible, but you know, there's got to be some sort of London play in there.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. I think we'll keep that on the back burner. But yeah, we're pumping episodes.
Just keep calling it After Dark. I honestly couldn't be less invested in how that segment works out. I mean,
that's true.
I feel like the whole thing. I feel like not to be a dick, but I feel like the whole show is pretty much can fall under that. It's not like at any point during the show you're kind of like, ooh, this is getting a little racy. Like that's.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, but I'm an immature person and I just like talking about stupid and inappropriate shit and I love to plug my own stupid takes in because I'm narcissistic. And yeah, I just thought, yeah, let's get another one in there because that was fun when we had it with that last person, but now it's not happening anymore.
I like how you can't even use this person's name. They left with such such indignity, but that's fair.
Yeah, they were not a fan of one of the episodes that went out. And so they
must say none.
Yeah, we will not disclose details of the lost episodes, but yeah, it was unfortunate.
All right. So, what did you just ask me about sucking my own dick? Yeah, great question, Bueno. I was just thinking about the last thing you asked. I was like, maybe I can turn it back on them and get something out of that, but I don't think I need to turn that on you. You guys do have 100 episodes, right? When I was breaking your balls for how terrible this is so far. I was saying this. It's not terrible, but it is completely formless. I'm just surprised you guys have been doing 100 episodes. Is that correct?
It's actually 125.
Wow. That is baffling. That is baffling to me.
Oh, yeah. We're free-forming it. Because after a certain point, like the questions we can ask – kind of only go so far, right? Like right. We have musicians on, they go
well,
so
I wouldn't know. You only asked me one at the start. I have no idea aside from Kanan, do you have any questions? Do you have anything, any topics you want to cover?
I'm just the side note guy, man.
Just the side note guy. Yeah, that's fair.
I'm just the Jamie.
No, you're not the Jamie. Jamie looks things up. You don't do that.
Bro, you know I would, but I got a bum ass computer.
You did that at one point in your early pandemic shows though, right? I feel like I saw a clip where you called something up. And did you guys lose that capability?
Well, like now that I'm doing it like on my laptop, like my laptop is so old that it can only like
run one thing
at a time.
Right.
So
yeah. So am I wrong, or at the start of pandemic where you want a better computer? Because I feel like I saw a clip where you called something up.
No, we're just sharing screen, and that was me. That was not
Canon. Oh, okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah, that was not Canon. I mean,
okay.
What was I gonna say? Oh, I had something, and then after a certain point, like it almost became legit. Almost after a certain point, like we interview kind of similar people around the city, like you know, musicians, artists, you know, comedians, entrepreneurs. Like there's a certain kind of question that you ask those people, and you know, you personalize and you look into some of their stories specifically, but. After a certain point, I'm like, you know what? I feel confident enough to let conversations flow. I don't want to have to ask every musician, be like, what inspires your music? And then they're like, yeah, well, you know, when I was in high school and XYZ, it's like, why don't we just talk? And then if it comes out in conversation, I'll try to pick more out of it instead of sounding like 60 minutes. Because there's nothing right. I hate more than listening to interviews. I want to hear people talk, not, you know, because that's how people are.
Right. Right. Fair enough. I think we started off talking about comedy, and then pretty much just immediately we ended up talking about the daughter. I don't mean to screw with the flow of it. I feel like now I've thrown the wrench in it, but
it's all good.
I was surprised you didn't have anything else specific then. What are you worried about in the world right now? I mean, obviously, yeah, you don't want to ask the same questions to every person, but there's got to be something that's timely and relevant that you want to get into or anything.
I mean, obviously, do you think that COVID is being co-opted to serve a bigger?
All right, great question. Now we're fucking around. Great question. Yeah,
Winnipeg's finest at dusk.
Yeah. COVID is being co-opted? Let's break it down a little bit. In individual instances, I'll say this: when Trump got COVID, I felt that was probably a ploy. Felt mm-hmm. like that was a ploy.
Me too.
Just so he could come out and then say, don't let it dominate you, which is one of the most ridiculous interviews. There was a presidential speeches of all time. I think there's room for the individual to manipulate it. Do I think it was overall constructed as a hoax by shadowy Bilderberg types in order to get us used to working at home so they can get us closer to the pod lifestyle that the overlords ultimately all want us to have? Maybe. No, I don't buy into that, but I do like that people think that some people out there think that, I'm sure. And why not? Let's at least have some divergent theories, and maybe one of them's true, and that person will never get their fucking day because the overlords will kill them before they ever get their message out. So, you know, you got to respect the people who were brave enough to say that before the overlords kill them.
Exactly. True. Like if you are one of those people that like believes in every conspiracy theory and you think like, yeah, this truly is a plandemic, you're getting shot first, like you said.
Yeah, so. Those people are heroes, because if they believe what they believe, then they know they run the risk of getting shot by the lizard people.
Yeah, it's true. I don't think it was planned. I think that's ridiculous. However, I do think it's taking on new meaning every day. I mean, you could apply that to everything, though, right? Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like now that is what it is, there's room for anybody to exploit it necessarily for a certain message. Like I said, I think Trump probably used it to his advantage. Otherwise, if he got it, you got to assume it would kill him. I mean, he's in terrible shape. You have to assume if he really had it, even with all the super drugs they could give you, that guy's got to be ready to die. His insides are just festering from years, decades of booze, high-priced fucking speed, just making his kidneys pump over time. I don't know how speed taxes the body, but I'm going to assume he's just all withered inside.
Yeah, I'm not going to fact check it. So if you want to just spout out some bullshit, I don't care.
Yeah. I don't believe in the overarching conspiracy, but now where people are like, well, you know, some... But also, like, I don't necessarily believe in, like, the most prevalent conspiracy now is, like, yeah, your governments are just using it to make you subdued. But it's, like, it's not really in the government's interest to have their economies tank, I don't think. So unless there's some 4D chess I'm not seeing there, I don't really see that yet.
I mean, have you heard of the isolation camps that they're building?
Isolation camps?
Yeah, it was on a government website.
No, I haven't heard of that. Is that just for supposed quarantining of people? And then people are now saying, like, these are the new internment camps. These are new POW camps or something?
Yeah, these are the new gulags. I've made a couple jokes about that in the last couple episodes.
Yeah, look, I don't hate that as a theory. I mean, if I was going to believe in any conspiracy theory, I think I just like to believe that maybe it was created for population control. That would be dope because we probably do need some sort of culling of the weak and the old. I tried to do that as a joke in that Rumors live show that I mentioned at the start. But like people were posting a lot of memes at the time, like showing, you know, there's deers in Central Park. It's like, maybe this is the planet's way of telling us that like we need to take a break. It's like the planet is not trying to tell us anything. If the planet was trying to tell us something, it's trying to tell us we have too many old people, right? There's only one conclusion you could draw from what the planet is trying to tell us. It's not telling us to like pause and like maybe fly less. Like, no, the planet is saying you need to stop warehousing old people, because obviously COVID, as we've learned in Winnipeg in the last few weeks, finds the places where we warehouse our old people and ravages them. And
we talked about this, man. Centicide.
Centicide?
Centicide. It's like the killing of old people.
Right. Well, what was the word?
Centicide.
Centicide. Interesting. I like that word.
Or cenocide. One of those two. Yeah.
Yeah, no. I also read The Stand a few years ago, which is the Stephen King book that is about a post-apocalyptic world. And he walks you through the whole breakdown of society first. A classic Stephen King book. It's like 450 pages are dedicated to like just the collapse. And then the last 500 pages are about the world after. So really it's two books by anybody else's goddamn standards, but he's such a monster of writing that it's one book and two stories. And that was a lab. The first chapter starts and this military guy is escaping a base that's going into lockdown. And it's clear that like he's got what he shouldn't be trying to escape. He should be just accepting that he's going to get locked in, but he beats, you know, the closing door, and then he gets this virus out into the world and immediately explodes and takes everyone out. So I think just for cool cinematic purposes, it would be cool if this was a designed virus that escaped the lab in a similar way. But unfortunately, I think it was probably just a random mutation that happened in a wet market.
Yeah, probably. And everybody's racing to see who can beat it and who can fix it to gain supremacy of the Western world and thus the world in their mind anyway.
Yeah, you know, I don't really know how the mechanics of like one country developing a vaccine works out. Like if they'll sort of, you know, make sure they get theirs taken care of first, or if there's some, I guess there would have to be like a mechanism whereby if somebody gets a good vaccine, you're obligated to share it. But it may be even not, because a country could say we have a good vaccine, and then it's not necessarily true because we need to test things like, maybe other countries wouldn't want that country's vaccine. I really have no idea. But yeah, ultimately don't believe it's part of a larger shadow conspiracy. Not willing to rule it out. I applaud the people who come up with these fun conspiracies, which give us all something to scoff at apparently, because we all know so much that we know shit. I definitely think that on the smaller time basis now it can be exploited, but there's just very few opportunities to exploit it. Like you kind of have to be Donald Trump, you have to be a world leader who's trying to send one message and your base believes it, and then you can undermine your opponent's message by going on TV and saying, I beat it, no problem. You know, don't let it dominate you. Unless you're Donald Trump, like I couldn't pretend to catch COVID and use it in any beneficial way. So trying to think of what other ways people can exploit it. I mean, I guess like the plastic sales, people are fucking loving it. The plastic salesmen are definitely would be the ones to push a catastrophic message, even if they don't actually believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my thing is like with the gulag theory. Okay, let's say with this ridiculous isolation camp, it gets out of hand and it becomes the gulag. And like all three of us are chilling in the gulag for some reason. I don't know. Maybe they listen to this episode and they like the chemistry best. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah,
we got some real fans in Parliament, I think. But let's say, you know, what would that serve? Like what ultimate purpose does that serve? You know, is it really worth it for the provincial leaders and the federal leaders to have everybody just controlled under this rule?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. Like the thing is like, obviously the world still had problems, but like it's always important when you get down the world to realize like we're living in the best time. Like there's never been a larger middle class. Do we still have huge disparity between rich and poor? Obviously, maybe some of the greatest disparity. And is there still like so much justice, but like there's a big middle class and you can be a part of it. And that's a dream. And like, that's good for everybody. It's good for everyone. Like the status quo was pretty good. If this was, if COVID was something that only happened in the Middle East, where governments are actually treating people so badly that they're willing to have, you know, an Arab Spring and overthrow and whatever, I might believe more that it was a conspiracy because suddenly the government was like, hey, just stay in your homes, don't come out and start stuff. But for it to be ravaging the world, like I think everybody else was, happy with the status quo. It's hard for me to imagine getting us into the gulags being better for Trudeau than having us in our homes and working.
Well, maybe this is a dumb 21-year-old line of thought here.
Oh, there's no maybe about it, but go ahead.
Thank you. But my question is, why would the government want to cock block us that badly?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's hard to imagine the scenario.
Like, if I can't ever get laid in my life again because Trudeau wanted to watch me twerk on somebody in a gulag, I'm going to be so fucking pissed. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, those are all the reasons to believe that it's not any sort of pandemic, as they say. And whoever thought of that name for that YouTube documentary, they were just creaming themselves. The plandemic person thought they had the greatest. And I didn't watch it. I watched like 2 seconds of it, and then you just see, okay, so it's all this lady, and then you go look, and you know, people say, well, this lady's an asshole. I was like, all right, yeah, maybe she's, and again, I just don't care. But they hit a home run with the name Plandemic in terms of what was going to appeal to the type of person who wants to watch that documentary. Plandemic is a great name. So again, you got to give it up. You got to give it up to these people.
Yeah. Oh, big time. Absolutely. I mean, but hey, for the conspiracy theorists that like really believe everything, Justin Trudeau is secretly Fidel Castro's kid. So.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course he'd want this.
Yeah. Is that just because his dad was friends with Castro?
No, apparently he looks exactly like him. Justin Trudeau, Fidel Castro, son. There we go.
Oh, yeah? Are you going to screen share it? Are you going to show off all your tech?
No, I'm feeling pretty self. No, I'll do it. Yeah, of course. Yeah, dog. I'm up in this bit. Okay, let's look at these pictures.
Whoa.
So this is Justin Trudeau and Fidel Castro at the same age.
I have family with stronger resemblances than that. That's not a great resemblance. The nose, I don't see anything.
Well, the nose is
not anything.
I can kind of see it. I can see it more when like he's older, but
they're both handsome. I'll say that. That bearded picture that you're highlighting right now, a little bit like just the way the smile is. But I think that's how people smile with no teeth. I like it. Look, I like a fun conspiracy theory.
But. Yeah, I can see the resemblance. Oh, this last one does not. This last one.
No, yeah.
Fidel looks like fucking Clay Thompson. He doesn't look like Justin Trudeau in that one.
Looks like Pablo Escobar on that last photo.
In the middle there, I just feel like they both have sort of good wavy hair, and that's the only thing that I'm supposed to assume makes them look alike. Other than the nose is different. Like, they both have big noses, but Justin seems more sort of. Well, I guess he's turned in these pictures, but it seems more narrow, and Fidel's just seems big and flat.
Fidel Castro kind of looks like Kyle Gibson in that first one.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. And I think that's the only one where he looks similar to Trudeau, and it's really, again, just because they're doing the same sort of closed-mouth smile, and their cheeks kind of look similar, but I don't get anything else, really.
Yeah, but even though his face looks a little rounder than Trudeau's, and Trudeau's eyes kind of turn down.
Yeah, I guess there's some other things.
Like this one doesn't look anything like him.
No, they just use the same little pencil mustache. That's what they're going for.
Yeah, literally. Even the hair is off too.
Definitely looks like Fidel has much darker eyes. Looks like Trudeau has sort of grayish, greenish eyes, and Fidel has brown eyes.
Yeah.
I like a good conspiracy. I don't even know what this is. I hope this is based on something like timeline wise that it would make sense that there was some sort of prime ministerial visit at the same time as Trudeau's conceived, because otherwise this is pretty flimsy. I'm reading a book right now, another Stephen King book, another 1,000-page book, 11/23/2263, which is the date I believe that Kennedy was assassinated. I might be off on the day. But and it's about a guy who travels back in time to try and stop the Kennedy assassination. And sort of the hitch of it is that obviously you could kill Oswald well before any of this happened. But he kind of wants to be sure, because there's so many theories. He's like, he doesn't want to kill Oswald in cold blood, and then it turns out that wasn't the guy who did it or whatever. So he has to stick around and actually like kind of wait to see it happen. Just speaking of fun conspiracy theories, I just wanted to shift the conversation to books, because I felt like it was better than going through all the pictures of Justin Trudeau and Fidel Castro.
I don't know. I was kind of enjoying that. I thought that was a real bonding moment.
Yeah, well, it looked like there was about 100 pages. So, like, we could have done it all day, which is what I felt like was going to happen. So
yeah, that would have been a great audio portion for the people listening at home, for the three people listening at home. They would have been like, oh, shit. I wonder if
I feel like that shows off your tech abilities. Like, maybe that, like I said, all we need from this, guys, is one great clip for your channel. And that at least shows that you can do some screen sharing and stuff. So that'll make people believe in your podcast.
Yeah, that's pretty pimp. Thank you. So in 11-22-63, he's a time traveler, you said?
It's a very specific kind of time travel. Basically, and I'm not spoiling anything, this is kind of all stuff you figure out in the first sort of chapter of the book. He has a rabbit hole that he discovers, that his friend has discovered. And you go through it and you go back to a certain day in 1959. And you come back in the exact same spot as you left, like in his small town. He comes out at exactly where he walks through the hole. That's where he walks into time in the past, always on the same day. And anything you take with you, you can take stuff back with you, and you can affect the past. You can, you know, carve your name into a tree. But when you come back into the present, you're, no matter how long you were in the rabbit hole, you come back 2 minutes later in the present. And if you go back in the rabbit hole, it's a reset. So, like, you carve your name into a tree and then go back in time and it's going to be there. But if you go back in the hole again and then you immediately come back through the rabbit hole, your tree, your carved name is gone because you didn't do it the second time. You restart every time you go through, which is any time travel story is always going to have paradoxes potentially. And this one kind of, it does a decent job of telling the story. There's still some paradoxes in, you know, that's inevitable with time travel, but there's fewer of them because of this mechanic, and it sets something up too. Cause it means that, like, this guy takes on this mission where it's, okay, I'm going to go back to 1959. I have to wait around 4 years, make sure it was Oswald. Then I can stop it from happening and save all these lives. Cause they predict the Vietnam War won't happen, all this stuff. But if you then come back to the future and then you go and for some reason you want to go back in time again, like, you're going to undo everything unless you wait around for another 4 years and do it again. So it's kind of like it's sort of a one shot deal in the sense that you can make things change once, but unless you're willing to do it again, you have to stay in the future that you return to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why doesn't he just, like, go back, shoot Lee Harvey Oswald on site and then go forward and then wait 4 years? Oh, he still got murdered. Okay, go back.
Yeah, I suppose that would have been one approach to go back in time, immediately shoot Lee, and then come into the future, see if it had the desired effect. And if it didn't, then okay, now I'll go back and now I'll wait for 4 years and actually go see who did it. I suppose that doesn't get floated. I think presumably what would be the hitch there is that then you are killing a guy in cold blood. Okay. Even if you can go back and undo killing him, you did kill him one time in cold blood, which is something that the narrator really struggles with.
I mean, but like
that's not a bad point though. He could have given himself a chance. Though also there you'd have to wait till, like, I don't think there was good details on where. Oh no, Lee's in Russia. That's right. Lee's kind of in Russia until like 1962. So you've got to wait around for like 3 years or so, kind of, to get your shot at him, unless you're going to go to Russia, which would be a whole other goddamn obstacle.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Because I was going to say, like, why don't you just go back in time, do like a whole rampage, and then just go forward in time? And
yeah, you're right. That would have been impossible, except that, yeah, Lee in that era is living in Russia. Because I didn't know this about Lee Harvey Oswald. You read it in the book, but I guess he defected to Russia because he loved communism. But he's sort of an asshole. And, like, basically, he didn't get along in Russia. He redefected back to the United States. But still loved communism, so he's sort of giving out leaflets and getting fired from jobs because he's telling everybody how, like, we got to support Cuba and stuff, you know, like, Cuba's the last perfect example of communism, and they're doing it right, and they're getting bullied by the state. So he was just an ornery dude, as you can expect from someone who shot a president. Was it sort of antisocial, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Or was it really Lee Harvey Oswald?
Or was it? I'm going to find out in about 200 more pages of this book.
I was just going to say, is that book mad propaganda for perpetuating a lie that the FBI actually killed John F. Kennedy?
I don't think it's mad propaganda for anything other than time traveling to 1959. That's what it's mad propaganda for. The guy goes back and he's like, on this, you know, it's obviously a crazy trip, but he buys like a Sunliner. He's got knowledge of the future, so he just makes some money gambling, makes a nest egg. And like the first, before he goes on the Lee Harvey Oswald mission, kind of do like a little test run where he changes something that he only has to wait around like a month for to find out about. And And he describes like that month of living in 1959 where, you know, ground beef costs 50 cents a pound. And he's driving this sweet Sunliner and he's just hanging out at this cabin and stuff. He says it was the greatest time of his life or whatever. So that's what it's propaganda for. It really makes you want to time travel to 1959.
Yeah, facts. And you do all the things that they do in Back to the Future 2 where he bets on all the games. And
yeah, it's actually, it's interesting because you'd assume that that's how you get along. But Stephen King is a genius writer. So, you know, he takes a, that's not as easy as you would think, bueno, because if you think about where you're placing these types of bets in that time, basically the narrator can't just make sort of all the money he would like from it because he starts to run afoul of bookies and stuff who don't like losing money to him, obviously. Mm. So nothing's as easy as it seems.
So they're like the you know, the whistleblowers who are saying there are, you know, bird people trying to kill us and subdue us. They're going to get shot first, right? Like same thing. If he runs up all the bookies, he's going to get killed.
Yeah, that's pretty much so that's an obstacle to in his goal.
Okay. So I know you love reading and stuff. What's the best book that you've read this year?
Okay, that Stephen King book, The 11/23/50/63 is a great book, one of the best page turners I've read. My grandfather, Sidney Green, has a memoirs called Rise and Fall of a Political Animal. Mm-hmm. And I read it maybe 10 years ago. He wrote it in 2003 or published it in 2003. I read it. It probably took me 7 years to read it, which makes me a bad grandson. But I think when I read it then, like, I just didn't really appreciate really like what he was describing getting accomplished. Like, he was in the NDP in the 69 Schreyer government that they came to power. They were like a nothing party and they created a party and they got in in their second sort of election cycle. And then they made all this shit happen. They made MPI happen. There was battles then in terms of for healthcare, how it was going to be charged to the average citizen. And they made all this stuff happen. And he's a good storyteller. And yeah, if you want a page turner, Rise and Fall of a Political Animal by Sidney Green.
Oh, that is cool. Yeah, it's here on Amazon. Damn.
Yeah. Probably no copies available on Amazon, but I can make a copy happen for anybody. Add me at Mike Green Who on Instagram. And yeah. Me if you want to read this book, because I will make sure you get a copy and Sid Green will be so thrilled because I think he has 400 in his basement. But yeah, it's just cool to read some words. And he was a guy who ran afoul of people because he told it like it is. And obviously to some degree, I consider myself the same way. So it's a fun read.
Yeah,
it
runs in the family.
Yeah, look, when you're right, you're right. You know, sometimes you got to tell people you're right. Sid Green didn't apologize for it. I don't apologize for it. And you know, it's the cross that we bear sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's got their own thing. Everybody's got
their own. What's another great book I read though? I'm gonna open my Goodreads now. It's hard.
Oh, you use Goodreads too?
What I've read. Yeah, I kind of just started, so I was trying to populate my list, and I was just trying to remember things that I've read. I read some real bad. I'll tell you books I didn't like before. Okay, worst book I read so far this year: Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy. It's the same guy who wrote No Country for Old Men and The Road, which are both books that got turned into movies. Have you seen No Country for Old Men or The Road?
No, I haven't.
No Country, yes, I have.
Yeah, okay. Good for you, Kanan. A shame on you, bueno, that you haven't seen it. Dope movie. I hate to be honest, people are like, you got to see this, but like, you really should have seen that. Unbelievable movie.
Definitely, I agree with you. That's definitely one of those movies that's like a have to see.
Yeah. And The Road is like, you don't have to see it. It's honestly a tough watch because it's so depressing. And the book, it was funny. I watched the movie, which is another post-apocalyptic story. And Viggo Mortensen's just with his kid and everything's completely burnt out in the future. And he's just fighting for survival. Their feet are all fucked up because there's not enough socks left even. And they're just walking. Just so stressful to watch. Like, two different times in the movie, he has a gun to his kid's head because they have this gun with two bullets left or one bullet left. And they're always just in situations where he's like, oh God, like cannibals are about to eat my son probably. So I better shoot him dead. And it's just the most heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching movie. And for some reason, I was like, I wonder if the book would be any more enjoyable. So I read the book, like 10 times more stressful. It's just like the movie, but like plays out, you know, he's got the gun to the kid's head like 5 times in the book. I'm like, God damn it, this is stressful. But it's definitely a well-written book. No Country for Old Men. The book is almost exactly like shot for shot what the movie turned into. So it's great. And then Blood Meridian is his first book. And it's just like 350 pages of descriptions of the landscape, in Mexico and southern U.S. and descriptions of scalping Apaches and just being terrible and violent. It's this band of, like, I don't know if you call them soldiers. They just kind of get hired to, like, collect scalps for bounty. And it was just one of the toughest reads. And I don't quit on books. I'm like 200 pages in before I realize, like, this is not going to change. But now I'm only 150 pages from the end, so I have to get there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, Blood Meridian was a tough one.
Damn.
Yeah.
Really, that just seems like a gross pastime. Like, I got to collect all these scalps. Like, that's...
Yeah, you're getting $10 a scalp. I mean, you know, if you're... in that era, I guess you're just going to get scalps. There's nothing else to do.
What kind of trash conversion rate is that? You got to go through all this trauma of killing a dude and scalping him. You'll get $10 for it.
I guess if you've done a bunch of them, then you're not, it's not that much trauma, you know. The first one's traumatic. I imagine the next 1,000 kind of go down easier and easier every time you hoist a scalp.
That's true. So are you purely like a fiction guy or?
No, in fact, I was looking through my list. I did read right before Blood Meridian. I read David and Goliath by Malcolm Gladwell.
That's one of the only Gladwell books I haven't read.
Yeah, I thought I'd read them all, and then I realized looking at his list that was out there, so I got that, and I did like it. Like all Gladwell, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt. And that one might be sort of less revelatory. Like for me, like Outliers, I think, is the one that I retain the most of and has the most sort of revelations, like the stuff he points out about how, like, if you look at pro hockey players, they all come from the first half of the year. So it's like, is it possible that every great pro hockey player, like, just happens to be born in the first half of the year? Is it more likely that because they get a little bigger, we focus on those kids earlier, those kids get the advantage, they keep rising and rising. And as he points out, like, imagine if we had two NHLs and one of them was for kids that just started, you know, had birthdays in June, like we'd likely have found a second Gretzky and stuff, you know, because that kid was out there, but he just was a little bit smaller, so he didn't get the double A practice, the triple A, and then it just magnifies. Anyway, yeah, Outliers being a great one with sort of revelations, then David and Goliath just being an interesting look at things. But
yeah, have you read Talking to Strangers?
Yeah, I read Talking to Strangers. I didn't find that was low down on the revelations list as well.
Really
well written. Like, what does he say about talking to strangers that, like, we kind of assume the, I can't,
default to truth.
Yeah, default to truth. Yeah, how people get conned, right? The Larry Nassar chapter, the Brock Turner chapter, where he kind of talks about what drinking does to us in terms of how we interact with each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some interesting stuff, but not, yeah, I guess it didn't make the same impact on me.
Yeah, I thought the Brock Turner example was a bit of a reach, but I could kind of see what he was going with it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, like, what he was saying in that chapter, as I recall, it didn't seem like a reach, but it just also didn't seem like it was not a revelation. Like, he points out that, like, we think, like, oh, just drinking does this to people. Like, no, there are these cultures where drinking isn't ritualized with sex and making these kinds of decisions. Mm-hmm. This whatever South American tribe where they pass around this grain alcohol and all just drink till they pass out and nobody starts groping each other.
Yeah.
And the idea that, yeah, like, this is what we've sort of built it up for, especially in the college means, so, like, then these things happen. Like, yeah, that's kind of, that might be true, but it's not anything I didn't think necessarily before, you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
David and Goliath, I'm trying to remember kind of what the big thrusts were. Well, yeah, they're just that you think that sometimes someone's a David, but in fact, it's a huge advantage or whatever. The struggle you have to overcome. Medium inspiring.
Yeah, I just got Blink. I'm gonna get into that one.
Yeah, Blink is good.
The I'm Tipping Point.
Quickly at my Goodreads right now. None of these were from the last year. A lot of Stephen King. Because the problem is, you go on to try and add books that you've read in the past, and just like, hey, well, I've read one Stephen King book. Well, let me go through all those others and quickly add those, and then yeah, I've added 30 of those and some sci-fi stuff I was reading. To answer your question, do you always read fiction? I think you gotta always jump around genres. When people say, like, I only read this, like, what, you don't think there's good mystery writers? You don't think there's good fantasy writers? Mm-hmm. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, there's great writers that are gonna gravitate. There's great comic book writers, and some people probably look that down. I'm not gonna read comics, I'm a kid. It's like, no, I mean, comic books have great storylines, like, sort of the infallible storylines that have existed through time, you know, the hero's journey and stuff like that, and great artwork. So, you know, you can't turn your nose up to anything.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. Have you, really quickly, have you heard The Tipping Point by Gladwell?
Yeah, I do remember the tipping point. I remember really liking it, but I can't really remember any of the takeaways from it now.
Yeah, me neither. I was like, yeah, I remember being like super captivated by it. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah. And I also remember hearing that his broken windows theory wasn't as foolproof as he thought it was in the book.
I've heard some sort of counter argument that broken windows theory lines up with something else that just happened at that time. The crime was maybe going to trend down at that point anyway, but I can't remember. Mm-hmm. You said really quick. Is it because we're approaching an hour and you want to get this done or what?
No, I thought we were going to transition to other books and I wanted to talk about.
Tipping points. I definitely remember liking. I was thinking about something else related to. I lost my train of thought too. My bad. Comic books. It's gone. It's gone.
Oh, okay. I read.
What are you reading right now, Kanan?
I'm like 10 pages in.
Oh, Outliers. Oh, there you go. So you didn't chime in. You could have. That would have. That
I was trying to find it. I was trying to find it, and then you guys were still going on. So I just. Okay. But yeah, nice. I'm like. This is. I think it's been bookmarked on this page for like a month. I haven't picked it up in a while.
But. So many other things going on, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah. So many more books to read. You know, just
so many COVID activities that are keeping you from doing it.
Exactly, man.
I read also a book that I really liked called Super Forecasting or Super Forecasters, and it was written by an economics guy. And like economics is there's two books that my friend had just given me, Black Swan and Bueno. Oh, you're muted.
Yeah, I just had to. Somebody shouted something at me.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's two books that a friend had given me, Black Swan and Thinking Fast and Slow, which are sort of, I guess, famous books, especially in the economics circle. And then I randomly happened upon Super Forecasting myself, just got out of the library. And it kind of ties in. I feel like those three are sort of like a holy trinity in terms of Thinking Fast and Slow. It talks about like how we choose things, like what's going on with our brains when we're trying to think. And then Black Swan is kind of like, well, what should we think about? And Black Swan basically makes the point that the things that do matter cannot be foreseen, cannot be forecasted, so it doesn't matter. Then Super Forecasting is about how we can make better predictions, and he acknowledges the, you know, Black Swan and that maybe some of these things aren't the things that you can count don't matter, and the things that matter can't be counted, kind of is like the crux that you come up against. But they're both super interesting to read.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I've had Thinking Fast and Slow on my list for a while. I'll have to get that. The problem is every time I get ideas of books, I always go on Amazon and add them to my list, and my cart's like 30 books full, and I'm like, Jesus.
Go to the library. That is my tip to the world. If this should be the soundbite that makes it online, go to the library. Everybody just use the goddamn library, and that's like the obstacle to reading is people like, oh, I don't want to pick up a book, or like, I don't want to have to make that choice and like, you know, spend money. It's not... Just go to the library. It doesn't really matter. You can get every book, and if you don't like it, you can get rid of it. You know, you can return it, and then you're not accumulating books. But then we're contributing to the librarian's jobs, you know. We're making the system work, our civil system work for us. Everybody just use the library.
Well, my thing was just like, not in terms of, oh, I don't want to have to buy these books. I love buying books. Like, I do not feel like buying a book is like an expense or, oh, that was money poorly spent. My thing is, it gets like there's so many goddamn books in there. I'm like, oh shit, there's a lot of books.
So then at a certain point, you are experiencing some bottleneck, and it comes to having the books pile up in your cart. And you may say it's not expense, but part of it is expense, and part of it is like just pulling. What am I gonna actually pull the trigger on? It feels like it's, you know, you're making more of a decision, and that's related to only being able to pick, you know, a few at a time or whatever. But yeah, just go to the library. And then also you say there's nothing wrong with buying books. There's nothing wrong with buying books. I used to like it too, until then you have a bunch of books. And that's the number one thing that's going to bury your corpse in your, you know, apartment in your old age, is this stack of books that like fell on you that you were trying to give away for years, trying to give away single books at a time. I used to always buy the books when I was a kid, and I took pride in it. I liked having a bookshelf. And then eventually you just realize, yeah, this is just pointless clutter. I reread a lot of books then, but honestly now I think it's kind of not dumb to reread books, but like not every book needs to be reread for sure. Most of the books that I bought, I didn't need to reread. So
that's fair. One of the books that I would definitely reread, I'm going to get to in a bit, is The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt.
Okay.
That's a very good book. And it kind of compares like old philosophy ideas with modern wisdom and psychology, and says like, okay, well, what does the true meaning of life, quote unquote. What does it truly mean to be happy? And the conclusion he comes to is the meaning of life is balance. And ultimately you need to find meaningful work and you need to love and like have that love component in your life and that fulfillment component. And you need to find balance, which I completely resonate with 100%.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonably good philosophy. I mean, again, might not be the most revelatory after you're, you know, not, no offense, but like when you're older than 21, you kind of realize that like that, that alone won't help. I think my philosophy is that, I, at the end of the day, for my existence, for my interpretation of the universe, I am the only lens that matters. Like when I die, the universe, as I know, will wink out of existence. Mm-hmm. So I am in a sense, the only way in which the world is really being perceived and interpreted and enjoyed. So it's my responsibility to live a great life and make the world, my world, and by extension, the entire world and universe as great as possible, make people happy, make every interaction as good as it can be, stay in great shape, because then it allows me to do more things with my body with, and experience the universe. Because again, like when I die, really, yeah, it's all going to wink out as far as I'm concerned. As far as I'm concerned, in a way, is as far as anything is concerned. All you really know is your own perspective or whatever. So, yeah, you got to live for the fierce joy of you and people say like, well, is that sort of like, could be like an asshole thing. Like you're saying like, you're the only thing that matters. Like, you know, you live selfishly, you may as well kill someone, right? It doesn't matter. You're the only thing, you're the only person that matters. And if my natural inclinations led me to do those things, then yeah, I would say that's true. But like, I don't feel like I don't have any desire to kill anyone, or I don't have any desire to be an asshole just because I could, and my feelings are the only ones that matters. I know for me personally, it feels better to make somebody else feel better. It feels better to make every interaction good. So, and I think that most people feel that way. There's definitely 10, 15, maybe even 20% of the population that, yes, would use that as an excuse to just be a super selfish asshole. But you can't account for that. You have to assume that most people are good, and that if most people could do the right thing in every instance, they would. If most people could help somebody else out, they would. And so the philosophy is just be great and make the world that you're experiencing the most happy, beautiful world, you know, that you can.
Well, I like that. And I think to kind of add on, not add on, but just kind of my own perspective on your point is that I believe the most important person in your life is you. And it's not to say be narcissistic or self-centered or, you know, disregard other people and their needs and wants, but it's just, you know, kind of comes down to the idea of, you know, I was raised Catholic, and the Catholic belief is God should be the most important thing in your life. And I couldn't disagree with that more. If you don't take care of yourself, how could you carry out God's will, right? In theory of whatever God wanted in that, your mission of life.
And the idea that you would ever deny yourself pleasure because it'll make the guy upstairs happy. Like, oh, I'm not going to have sex before marriage because it would make that guy happy. Or like, once, you know, I'm not going to have this kind of experience. I'm not going to do drugs because, and not that the Bible forbids drugs, but you start living for other people. Mm-hmm. It's just a pointless exercise, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You're delaying your enjoyment now for gratification later. And my theory on Catholicism is if the Catholic version of God is true, which is an all-loving, all-knowing, all-compassionate, all-forgiving, all-gracious God, he'll get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's chill, bro.
There's no way he'd make us the way he made us and be like, oh. Yeah, I'm writing that one down.
Exactly, yeah. And if there is a God like that, honestly, I do everything I can to anger that God. I try and have weird, freaky sex, because if there is a God, if it's that petty God, I want him to look down and be like, no, I didn't fucking give you that so you could do that. And yeah, well, you gave it to me, dude, and you gave me this impulse that makes this feel great, so like, I'm going to do it. I make no secret of it. I love rub and tugs. Big fan. Again, if sex work is work, I'm just a customer. Big fan of rub and tugs. This can be the soundbite. I don't care. Put it online. Big fan of rub and tugs. Go to Montreal. I get the high-end ones. Pay extra for the lady to get completely naked, slide all over you.
Do they just like lube up with like massage oil or what?
Yes. Nuru gel is the actual note, because the Nuru style massage is the one where they get completely naked. And big fan of rub and tugs. And again, if there's a God who's petty enough to give me this equipment and these urges and then get mad about it, I want to do it. Makes me want to do it 10 times more just that he can be looking down and getting so frustrated.
I couldn't agree more. So you go to Montreal and that she just slicks up and acts like, well, Bambi
on ice. To be clear, I go to Montreal for gigs back when there were gigs. I would go to the club there. But right. I would always make a point in the weekend to get down to my favorite rub and tub. I might say my favorite is the only one I ever went to there that a friend recommended.
So your favorite?
Yeah, so my favorite, but that makes it sound as if I've been to many or whatever. But yeah,
you're a rub and tub connoisseur.
Big fan.
Yeah, no.
Oh, no, you got to go to the one on Fifth Street. That's the money spot.
I guess I hope those girls are working now. You know, I hope that COVID hasn't hit them too hard because they do a great job. And that, you know, the funny thing is about the Nuru style massage is that it was it's 180, 170 all in, like $80 room fee, $90 tips of the girl. Or if you go before 3 p.m., it's only 60 for the room. So you save $20 if you get the early bird special, which I would do because I am a Chinese Jew. I would go early in the afternoon / morning for my Robin Tugs. And for that price, you get sort of a half hour of Thai massage where they kind of like they do just hand massage and you're chatting or whatever. And then they would start dumping the Nuru gel on you and kind of sliding all over you. It gets a lot more sexual and then finally give you the happy ending. And then one time I went and they always had like Nuru Extreme, which cost an extra like, I think $70. And I asked, what's the Nuru Extreme? Like, oh, well, they don't even like start with the hand massage. They just like immediately dump way more gel on you. Like the whole time they're just sort of sliding on you. They go into more positions. You still can't touch them. And you can't see like it's not penetrative in any way. And it's still just a happy ending with like a hand job. But they just said like it's more sliding. So one time I was like, you know what? Let's upgrade me to the Extreme. And because I'm Mike Green, pervert, wants to anger God, right? Let's make this filthy so God will be really mad. And you know what I found out? I kind of like the part where you talk. I kind of, not an extreme guy. I need that half hour of Thai massage. I need that half hour where you're just chitting and chatting and you're getting a good rapport and you're kind of flirty and whatever before all the body slide happens. So,
yeah, and you're getting massage too. Like, that's nice.
Yeah, the massage is always terrible. I'm going to be honest. These ladies, they don't have what it takes to make it as easy as they would be doing it. So they're really, it's really, look, it feels good to be touched. And some of them make an effort and like, but I just like not to, as I already bragged before when I said, hey, it's part of my job to be in unbelievable shape, right? To enjoy the world. You know, I have dense muscle fibers, right? Bueno, I need a real, if I'm going to get a good massage, I'm going to need someone with strong hands actually needing, these ladies cannot provide that. But what they can do is flirt with you and be really sexy and then provide a spectacular finish at 1 p.m. in the afternoon.
That's fair. I mean, my thing is, because like, I've never come from a hand job. So my question would be like, obviously, they can probably get it done, but like, oh,
you haven't had these hand jobs, bueno. Go on the website for Nuru Montreal and you can look at who's working now. And I promise you, somewhere. And that's the other thing. It's the whole experience. You walk up and for some reason, I'll admit, there's something else that I like where Montreal is a place to do it because it's like pretty socially accepted. Like, these are not illegal operations. They tell you up front, like, okay, so I'm going to give you a massage. I'm going to give you a happy ending. You know, it's not like you're not worried about the cobs bursting or whatever. But even though it is socially acceptable there, like, I realized something for me maybe the second or third time I went, like, I build it up in my head. Just, if not that it's socially unacceptable there, that I know still a lot of people wouldn't do it, a lot of tourists wouldn't do it because they'd be worried or whatever. And, like, I like the, my heart beats a little faster as I get closer to the building. It's not because I'm excited for that. It's like I'm excited for the wrongness of it, that it feels like I'm pulling something off here. So you go in and your heart's already beating a little fast. And then they're very friendly, very professional. You get in the room and then the girls come through. The women, and they come through in a parade. You're like assaulted. Like, they come through and they introduce themselves and like, hey, I'm Vicky. And then the other, you know, the attendant will come back and be like, which one do you like? You're like, you know what? I think I would like Vicky today. And then they come in. It's great. It's just great. You feel like assaulted. It's amazing.
So it's like that scene in Harold and Kumar when they escape Guantanamo Bay, where they go to the whorehouse and they like walk all the women out in front of them and they're like, oh, that one.
Yeah, but honestly, I feel like that would be a bit more. Also, you call it a whorehouse, which makes everything seem less dignified.
Oh,
but I'm sure that's what it was in the movie. But these are not whores; these are nice ladies, and they don't all have to stand in a line, which I feel like would be more degrading, or at least like kind of this. Like, they come in one at a time, and you introduce it, and you say hello, you know, and then they go back out, and then it's not like they're all looking at me and I'm picking one. And that would be, feel like I'd be disparaging all of the others that I didn't pick, you know?
That's fair. I could see that.
Yeah.
I don't know where to go with this. So I'm going back to books there.
All right, fair enough.
I'll let you know the direction.
Books. That's what I'm all about. Any of those topics.
I read this book. I think you'd find it really fascinating. It's called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. You ever heard of it?
I think I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, it's by John Ronson. It's very good. And it's, okay. I mean, when I read nonfiction books or self-help books or psychology books or whatever, I usually like to take notes. And this book, I didn't take a lot of notes, but I retained a lot of the info. So that was nice for me because it's like, oh, he's a really good storyteller. It was engaging, captivating. And that's the book where I read that the Tipping Point had some faulty reasoning in it, actually.
Okay. What was he publicly shamed?
No, office? But he interviews people who were, and it's okay. Really fascinating.
Who does he interview?
Jonah Lehrer. If you remember, he was a science fiction author who was, he fabricated some details in a book that he wrote about Bob Dylan.
Okay.
And he was lit up. This is like when Twitter first started becoming popular back in like 2013. He did this public apology and they did like a tweet live stream right next to him on this screen. And people were just lighting his ass up as he's trying to apologize. Yeah, it was brutal. Okay. Do you remember Donglegate?
No.
It was a lot of people who I talked about this don't seem to remember, which kind of not frustrates me, but like it's a really fascinating story. I wish more people knew about it. So these two guys were making these like jokes side by side at this tech conference about just like kind of like crude humor about like, oh, dongle. It sounds like, you know, dong, the big dongles. Ha ha ha. Let me fork your repo, which means like copy software. They're just being gross silently to each other. And this woman gets up a row or two ahead of them, turns around, takes a picture of the crowd. And they just kind of think like, oh, whatever. No big deal. We don't know who that is. And then later they found out she posted that on Twitter saying like, oh, these guys made me feel really uncomfortable joking about big dongles and this and that. And like, this is not appropriate, guys. You shouldn't have done this. And yeah, huge eye roll, especially since her tweet before that was a penis joke to her friend.
Okay. Yeah. And like, it sounds like they weren't on a panel or anything. They were joking with each other but they were being probably obviously louder than they should have. Yeah. That was the joke. Okay. Yeah.
They're just kind of in the crowd. And so she tweets that and one of the guys actually gets fired from his job. And so he posts on like this online forum, and this is where shit goes bonkers. He posts on this forum being like, hey, I know so-and-so. And like, obviously everybody knows her name because she tweeted it. So he says like, hey, I know so-and-so. Like, I know you're made uncomfortable. That was never my intention. I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings. I'm sorry that I made you feel that way. That's not cool. And she kind of takes the angle of like, you know, as a woman in tech, you know, this is very intimidating to have, you know, men.
Right.
And so he's like, I didn't know your background experience. I'm sorry. That being said, like, I really wish that you would have talked to me or told somebody at the panel so they could have come and said something to me rather than tweeting about it, because I lost my job. I have a family and I really like that job. And then 4chan got a hold of this and people on 4chan just went fucking ape shit. Like, they
attacking the woman.
Yeah. Trying to track her down, telling her like, I hope you get murdered and like trigger warning raped. And somebody like cuts your uterus out with an X-Acto knife. Like, people went nuts, ballistic nuts. It was fucked. And this woman ended up getting fired too. And now, according to John Ronson at the publication of the book, she still didn't have a job. It'd been in like over a year.
Yeah. That's what happens when you put misery out into the world. Like, I mean, I'm not saying that she didn't feel the way she felt, and that is unfortunate, but she definitely tried to amplify it and put it back on them, and then it comes back on you. And that's why you just, as I said, just try and make the world, try and have as many wholesome, genuine interactions as you can, rather than just putting out the negative shit. And Twitter really exists only as a vehicle to enhance negative shit. The funny thing for me is now I just go on there. Like, I stupidly started using Twitter just at the start of COVID because I wanted to see what the numbers were, and I found it was the easiest thing that I could open. It would show me the worldwide numbers. Then they passed a million cases. I stopped caring because everything stopped seeming like had any scale at that point. But then I was still opening the app every morning and checking, and then I would look at tweets and I just realized that like it's just the shittiest, snarkiest place on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to have some interactions on there, and people are just immediately shitty. And so now I rarely use it, but the only thing I will do is just try, and I'll go on there and just sort of say positive things, like give a book recommendation. Or like, people just don't really know how to interact with you on Twitter if you're being nice. They are so ready for the fight, and that's all they want.
Yeah. When the author talked to this woman at the time of publication, he was like, oh, like, do you regret what you did at all? She's like, no, they were being loud and rude and they deserved what came to them. It's like, okay, like, Jesus Christ, woman.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't feel bad that she lost her job. However, the 4chan thing, that angle is like, she's got to, you know, move locations, go off the grid completely. Yeah, that's way too much.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt that just a mob mentality is like on the internet. I mean, it's always, it can only go one way, doxing and then just nonstop harassment, just nonstop torrents of abuse. It's why you just don't get involved.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's a very, very good book.
I'll honestly, so you've been publicly shamed. I'll put it on my list right now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Also, if I can provide one more recommendation for The Sign of the Times and a nice easy read that was minimal notes for me and interesting storytelling, The Coddling of the American Mind. You ever heard of that?
I have not.
Yeah, how... I think the byline is how good intentions and bad plans have set a generation up for failure.
Yeah, I can see that. I'll put that on the list right now too.
Yeah, great book by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff.
Yeah, he nailed it. Rated 4.24 out of 16,000 ratings. That's pretty high.
Yeah, it's stellar. It's a great book.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what they say specifically, but I do believe that's happening. Not just the American mind. I mean, You ever see the Evergreen College sort of debacle?
They talk about it in there.
Yeah, and look, we saw microcosms of that in Winnipeg comedy and in Canadian comedy. People from marginalized groups suddenly speaking out with a certain fervor that was just surprising and had, I used fervor, like it wasn't a conversation. It was you've had your turn long enough. It's time to shut up. You know, get in our canoe. Do our things or whatever, and only on the surface, very very surface level, with no scrutiny and no willingness to push back, did any of that seem genuine? Whether it was in Canadian comedy or in the Evergreen College, like you can watch at the start, and it's not like it started off well reasoned and rational. It started off aggressive and like, yeah, only on the surface would you say like, well, this person is black and they're telling me I don't know what the black experience is like, so I guess. Yes, I'm going to take everything for granted and just assume this is genuine. And then, but if you used your brain or your heart at all and looked minorly beyond that, you'd be like, no, this is just one person who wants power. Like this is the person who's found a mechanism for getting power, because if you give any pushback, they can then say you're racist, which is in this climate the most damning thing. Or marginalize it, or silencing women, you're silencing oppressed voices. The most damning accusation. So that's definitely going on. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
We just weren't meant to have social media and the internet. Our brains aren't right. When I sort of say that these things are bad, I also don't know how it could have worked out any other way.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, and to kind of add to the point you're making, like it doesn't delegitimize your experience if you've been, you know, if somebody's, people have treated you in racist manners or oppressed you or whatever because of who you are. Yeah, that sucks, but that doesn't give you, you don't get to go like bash somebody for that.
You know, you don't get to lock the faculty in. You know, I just watched the Evergreen College thing, so it's like more prevalent in my mind. But
yeah,
I mean, those like 21-year-olds were acting like terrorists pretty much, and it's just amazing to see the professor is sort of kowtow to it because nobody wants to get called out and be made the target of their ire. But
and the dean like applauded them afterwards too. He's like, "Oh, they did great work."
It's yeah,
like,
the dean stuck with it at the end, refused to renounce any of it. And it's funny because there were some moments where you can see that he knew he'd created a monster, but again, they weren't outright targeting him, so it just still worked out to go along to get along. But when you watch some of that stuff, like the canoe meeting, which is for anybody watching, like something the students held, the panel that had been assembled to address the imbalance in power and racial inequity and stuff. They had this meeting where they lined up all the faculty and told them, like, you're going to get in our metaphorical canoe now. This is going to symbolize you all paddling with us. But first, before you get in the canoe, you need to stand there and ask us and beg to get in the canoe. And like these faculty members all sort of stand up and they're terrified and saying, I just really want to be the best ally I can, and I would like to get in the canoe because I know I haven't done. And they just sort of supplicate themselves. And I was at some meetings. I was at some meetings in venues here that were designed supposedly to make things safer And it was just absolute garbage. And I told the people who ran it at the start, and they chose not to listen. And then things went further and further. And,
I caught wind of it.
Kind of reached our head here because, like, sort of the biggest spearhead of this whole movement, not just in Winnipeg, but somebody who went on to do it across Canada, was Shanti Marostica.
I heard about
that. One top comic. And a lot of the winning of top comic was based on if you don't pick me as the first transgender winner of this competition, you are oppressing trans voices. You're just reinforcing. It was the Evergreen College. It was you're racist. You're whatever. And the one and like this was the biggest leader, and then ultimately turned out to be the biggest perpetrator of sort of sexual violence and sexual assault that the community had seen, and it all kind of blew up on them. And what's funny is that all the people who rallied behind Shanti in the aftermath just never walked back any of their support, never addressed it, never. And we don't get to, as a group now, get to step back and say, like, oh, all the things that we were doing in the last years, you know, things of this canoe meeting type nature where you get to call the shots. Like, do we get to maybe now address that any of that was maybe not predicated on making spaces the safest, but more predicated on just certain people consolidating power? No, there's no conversation that goes on like that.
Yeah, you know, as far as the Winnipeg stuff goes, I'm just so shocked and offended that nobody asked me to attend these meetings and nobody saw me as a real comic to show up. In all seriousness, so I'm glad I was left out.
I'm sure you would have been welcome at, there's really only the one in Winnipeg that went down. The other one that I'm mentioning was like a training thing. It wasn't necessary, but it was equal bullshit to all the things that
training thing. About.
Yes, yeah, so it's sort of on how to run things safely, but it was the people who were running it were not confident. I'll say it right now. I'd say it was red tent training, and if those people have a problem with me saying that they don't give adequate training, that they're sort of nonsense, hey, we can have that conversation any day of the week. I would love to talk about the weaknesses that I saw in that training. It was just sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think Mike Green backs down from the smoke, but that's word on the street.
Not after reading Sid Green's memoirs. You know, like, he really pumped me up. He reminded me that I have the spirit of a Jewish litigator in me, and that training was just so cartoonishly bad. Not just from the standpoint of, like, I think it was very suspect that they were accomplishing the things they said they were doing, but just also logistically, like, the two people running it didn't know how to run a meeting. It took 2.5 hours. Should have been 45 minutes to go through their stupid exercises. We weren't jumping into a canoe, but we were doing things of this nature. We were sort of, stand over here if you feel it. And it was like, if I was in grade 9, I might have been, like, not getting something out of it, because, again, their message was so garbled, but I would have maybe just, like, respected the authority. But I think even in grade 9, I would have had the wherewithal to be like, you guys don't really know what you're doing. Like, you shouldn't be running this. Like, this is not a good program.
What was the training? Like, what were some of the exercises?
There was, for starters, one of the first things we did was everybody in the room wrote down things that they liked about the comedy scene, and then put it on sticky on the board, and then wrote down things that they didn't like, they thought, you know, made things less safe or whatever, and wrote it. But we were encouraged to do both. And so it seemed immediately kind of like, just like, there was as many good things as bad things on the board. So kind of, it was a weird way to get, like, and also just the semi-anonymous nature of doing it by writing, but then it really didn't, really anonymous because we were all doing it. And then the next drill was also a thing where, we need more space to do this next exercise. Let's go on the other side of the room, and we're going to say a statement, and then you stand over here if you think the statement is true, you stand over here if you don't, and you stand in the middle if you're a little, you know, on the fence. So why do we need to be standing for this? Like, this is something that we could have all been doing when we were sitting and just raising our hands. It doesn't make any, the visual representation isn't helping us. Again, it's just slowing things down and making this a 2.5 hour meeting. It's very childish and, like, seems like contrived by people who just feel like this is, you know, we're doing an activity, like, this should be maybe for grade 9 students, probably even they would feel it was lame.
Because I need to insert a shitty joke. When they asked things you didn't like about the comedy scene, did you write, people beg me for stage time?
I don't remember what I wrote. I might have abstained. I don't remember what I wrote, but look, honestly, I don't like that. I accept that as a facet of running rooms, that I will always have people asking, and this is the life I chose. So I don't, I wouldn't say I hate that. I accept it.
Bueno, anyway, won't leave me alone.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, then we did this stupid the stupid standing on one side. And then one of my favorite parts in terms of, again, just like, hey, and hey, Red Dead, you got a problem, like, get at me. Like, I'm so ready to argue it. One of the funniest things to me was we were back in the first room, and the person leading the meeting said, okay, so we need to get into two groups, and I need some way to sort of divide us, you know, into groups. And they're looking around, they're hemming and hawing. I'm trying to get to watch the Chelsea Tottenham game. You know, this is a big game. I've given up. I've sacrificed my Saturday morning for this already. I'm getting a little frustrated. The person who, another person, not with the red twin, somebody else said, okay, we need to be in two groups. How about just 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, you know, go around the circle. Great solution. Should be, let's get this going, right?
Sure.
Red 10 person's like, oh yeah, okay, good idea. Okay, so give me two things that are the similar but not the same. And then some of you alter, like, then we get to apple to orange. So then you can go around the circle, apple, orange. But, like, even just that extra 5 seconds that they took, that bothered me because it was like, yo, what was wrong with 1-2, 1-2, 1-2? Like, why did you, like, we're not children. You didn't need to come up with something. Okay, this is an apple. You're an apple. You're an orange. You're an apple. You're like, it was so poorly run.
Yeah, numbers are hard, Mike.
They'd already been given the numbers. We were right where we needed to be with some.
Memorization's hard.
Why didn't we just do 1-2? That was me when I was like, I'm dealing with morons here.
Yeah. Jesus, that's funny. No, yeah, you'll so if people come at you, you'll be equipped with the Evergreen documentary and the coddling in the American mind, and the other hand, just
yeah, and my own experiences. I saw it firsthand. That meeting was run by people who didn't. I don't want to say those people didn't have a genuine interest in me. The Red 10 people, the one thing I can say is, yes, I will say they probably do have a more genuine interest in safety and whatever than others, but they're not qualified to give it, as near as I can tell. Certainly not in the experience of the one workshop that I did, and I imagine that's the workshop that everybody gets. And that, yeah, okay, if they're on the one end of the spectrum where they're just like incompetent, bumbling people, and at least they're good intentioned, that's the other end of the spectrum is you get people who don't have been, who are actually just trying to consolidate power. They're trying to lure people in by saying I can provide the safe space. You're going to get people who are a little bit weaker, kind of who are maybe traumatized and whatever, and then you just actually act as a beacon to find people to manipulate and exploit. And that's definitely what went on for many years at the far end of the spectrum.
Damn, yeah, that's unfortunate. I mean, I think especially with something like comedy, right? You try to be as limitless as possible in terms of what you can joke about. You know, what happens if you're workshopping a bit and it comes off a little more harsh than you would have liked, and then somebody comes after the show and says, hey, I think you're a piece of shit and you're a bigot because of that joke. And you're like, I was just trying to be funny. You know, I fucked it up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely, and the funny thing is that, like, that would be the only thing that you really could sort of do. No, I don't want to say it's the only thing you could do, but, like, yeah, that would be, I guess, the most direct way to seem like you're making a show better is to just outright say, like, nobody say anything that could be controversial. But, like, what does that mean? Like, you can have an elevator joke, and if somebody's dad died on an elevator, that joke might you know, affect them differently.
Yeah.
And you really just, you can't make every, you can never make the bar so low that everybody can walk over to get it. And, yeah, it's just a slippery slope, and the coddling of the American mind. I don't know exactly what it gets into, but I have a feeling I've experienced some of it.
Well, I mean, I'll summarize it. They talk about the three. They use the word untruth. When I told this to my brother, he's like, "Why don't they just say lie?" I don't know. They use the three great untruths that are kind of taught widespread today. Is that what doesn't kill you makes you weaker? You should always listen to your emotions, and the world is a battle between good and evil people. So for the people who don't understand what I'm saying, don't believe those three things I just said.
Yeah, I'd say those are, that's a good way. Definitely, like, what was the first, don't believe your feelings, or don't act on your feelings? Or?
It's always listen to your emotions. So people are taught to always, like,
whatever always your listen emotions to your emotions saying, is the untruth.
Yes, always.
Yeah, and I definitely, and this is definitely the one of the problems, and what became, like, what is clear in the Evergreen documentary is people start saying, like, this is my truth, like, this is how I feel. Are you telling me that the way I feel is invalid? It's like, well, I'm not saying that it isn't valid, but, like, what if somebody else feels completely differently? And what are you invalidating their truth? You have to acknowledge that your truth is, at the end of the day, just your truth. It's not necessarily a... And it's funny in that documentary that the one professor is getting called a racist by the panel, and some of his minority students try and speak up, and they just get shouted down twice as harshly. And it's like, well, yeah, this you might say we're minorities. We're telling you that we feel threatened by you. But if then somebody else from the minority says, actually, I feel fine with this person. It's like, shut up, co-conspirator. You know, like, oh, okay, well, now you're denying their truth. So you can't, we can all have our truths, but they just, they all have to exist and they can definitely contravene each other. So
yeah, and that's right. Like just because your truth is valid and your feelings are valid doesn't mean it justifies everything you do after that, because my pain will, you know, justifies every single action. No, what they talk about this in the book, that a lot of people would like try to shout down speakers or get them banned from universities because they didn't like the message. It's like, you don't have to go, right? One. And two, if you really don't like it, why don't you just create your own speaker event with somebody who you like, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's weird, right? Because I think like you're going down, some minorities trying to speak up. This weird movement of, you know, we amplify all marginalized voices unless they disagree with us, then fuck.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it kind of, I remember I was pitching some show ideas to you, and one of the things that I said was like, oh, why don't we have like a show of people of color? And you're like, that kind of feels like tokenism to me. And that kind of, you know, the gear started shifting in my head. I was like, wait a second, he's right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, and don't get me wrong, like there's, people love a theme, it probably would have been fine, but it's just, I don't really feel the need to put on those shows necessarily.
Yeah. If the most interesting thing about our comics are, look at how diverse we are.
Yeah, exactly. That's a weakness right there.
Yeah, it feels like, okay, we're not focused on, because, and it's not to say like, oh, somebody's going to hear this and be like, Nicholas Buono's a racist piece of shit. I don't even know what race he is. Fuck him. He's too tall to be oppressed. Fuck him. But, you know, it's not to say we don't have good black comics or indigenous comics. It's just, if you're just picking people because of who they are and how they identify, I think that's weak. There are qualified people of those certain groups. You don't need to.
And honestly, that's the funny thing too. And again, in terms of what got thrown around in the shanty era, you know, suddenly we need the woke comedy because these people have no other place to do it because the scene is so white and bigoted. Sirs, my mom is, I'll show you a picture of my Chinese mom eating a bowl of fish heads. Okay. I've been in this for 10 years. I was one of the first people running shows, and I'm half POC. I'm half minority. And, welcoming to me, Paul Rybalskis is Aboriginal and is, just been celebrated in our city for 10 years by, if not the comedy fest, like they never gave him good shows, but like all the comics and just fans of comedy in the city know he's great. A guy like Rajat comes into town and is instantly just given, you know, as many shots as we can get him because we understand that this is good. And it's not because he's good. So like, yeah. So the funniest thing is the woke people, it's like, well, is the problem really that the scene isn't welcoming? Because here's a fucking Chinese Jew, an Aboriginal, and an Indian guy, and they were getting, you know, I'd never complained about not getting my fair share. So it's a problem that you're not getting your share, is that you just want to consolidate power. You want more than, you want to make sure you're getting more than your share. You want to destroy the other shows that don't specifically lift you up. Like that's always been the funniest way of promoting a show to me. There's so many shows that say, come to this one, we're the only one who does it. We don't do this, and the other shows do. It's like, so the best thing you can say about your show is that you're not this other successful show. Like your show only has value by tearing another show down. I've never ever promoted that. And the other thing that I don't ever do, which, you know, I never use the word support. And that's another thing that these people use constantly because you can't stand behind the product. So like, come support, like, no, don't ever come support Mike Green. I'm not a child's recital. I don't need your support. Come because the entertainment is good and that's worth it. Everything else is just leveraging emotions and leveraging guilt, you know, just and asking people to beg your permission to get in the canoe or whatever.
Yeah, I remember you telling me that when I first started the podcast. You're like, I never want people to support me. I want them to actually like what I do. And I was like, huh. You know, I'm not sure how fully behind that statement I stand, but I really like the angle of it anyway.
Don't get me wrong. I like if somebody supports. I appreciate if somebody likes me enough that they want to go out of their way. But like, just come to the show. Why? Because you should support local comedy. No, come to the show because it's a great show. That's why you should come to the show, you know?
Yeah, I like that. I like that. You want to entertain people, right? You don't want to be seen as a charity case. Anyways, let's wrap up. Yeah. Mike, this is awesome. It was great to chat with you again and to see you. The quarantine beard's looking gnarly. I really like it.
Thanks. Yeah. This flat is, there's less pixels in my webcam, so you actually it flatters and makes it look fuller and better, I think.
Okay, perfect. Is there anything you like?
Because it still doesn't look like a great beard. It's still like, I have Keanu Reeves hair. Like when I first started not shaving during COVID, someone's like, oh, you get like a Keanu Reeves beard. I'm like, don't say that. Nobody would allow Keanu Reeves to have that patchy facial hair if he wasn't Keanu Reeves, and I've always felt that. And I have 100% the patchy coverage of Keanu Reeves, but
it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah,
we'll figure it out. Is there anything you'd like to say or leave the people with before we go?
When does this come out?
I'll figure it out. It's probably.
Well, do you think it comes out this week or what?
Next week for sure.
Next week. Okay. I was gonna promote a show on Halloween, but no point.
Yeah. Shit. Well, we hope you guys enjoyed the show on Halloween. Yeah. Okay. This is us signing off Winnipeg's Finest. Mikey, thank you so much. Everybody have a great week.
Peace. Thanks,